In 1961, the world expected to see a demon in a glass booth. Adolf Eichmann, architect of the Holocaust's logistics, stood trial in Jerusalem. And what emerged was far more unsettling than any monster. Here was a balding, middle-aged bureaucrat who spoke in clichés, complained about his stalled career, and seemed incapable of understanding why everyone was so upset. Hannah Arendt's account of this trial would ignite one of the 20th century's fiercest intellectual battles, not because she defended Eichmann, but because she revealed something we desperately didn't want to believe, that the greatest evil in human history was carried out not by fanatics or sadists, but by ordinary people who simply stopped thinking. This wasn't the comfortable narrative of good versus evil we craved. It was a mirror reflecting our own capacity for moral blindness when we substitute independent thought with following orders, when we replace human connection with bureaucratic procedure. The Jerusalem courtroom was pure theater. Black-robed judges on an elevated platform, the defendant behind bulletproof glass. Judge Landau fought to maintain judicial integrity, focusing on Eichmann's actual crimes. But Prime Minister Ben-Gurion orchestrated political theater to educate Israeli youth about the Holocaust and demonstrate Jewish heroism. Prosecutor Gideon Hosner became Ben-Gurion's voice, building cases around Jewish suffering rather than Eichmann-specific actions. This created cruel tension. The trial kept asking witnesses why Jews hadn't resisted deportation, ignoring reality. No population behaved differently under Nazi terror. When Dutch Jews attacked Germans in 1941, 430 were tortured to death. The trial exposed uncomfortable truths. Post-war Germany employed 5,000 of 11,500 judges who had served under Hitler. Courts issued shockingly lenient sentences to mass murderers, and Germany never demanded Eichmann's extradition, revealing a nation's ambivalence about confronting its past. Eichmann defied every expectation. Rather than evil incarnate, the court faced someone drowning in bureaucratic jargon. Born in 1906, he failed at everything, never finished high school, was fired from sales, and joined the SS only through family connections. He claimed no hatred for Jews, citing Jewish relatives and even a Jewish mistress. What made Eichmann truly disturbing wasn't hidden depravity, but his complete inability to think from anyone else's perspective. During 8 months of examination, he complained endlessly about failing to achieve higher SS rank, showing zero awareness of how inappropriate this was while being tried for genocide. The absurdity peaked when he visited an acquaintance at Auschwitz, greeting him as "my dear old friend" and lamenting their "rotten luck," as if they'd both suffered career setbacks rather than one sending the other to death. This wasn't a monster. It was something more terrifying. A man so disconnected from reality that mass murder became just another administrative task. The Nazi regime weaponized language to make atrocities psychologically bearable. Extermination became final solution. Deportations became resettlement. Victims became pieces. This pattern persists today. Collateral damage for civilian deaths, right-sizing for mass layoffs, creating emotional distance from human suffering. Heinrich Himmler framed genocide as battles which future generations will not have to fight again, making the killing of women and children sound necessary. His masterstroke was redirecting empathy inward. Perpetrators viewed themselves as victims, enduring unpleasant duties. The gas chambers originated from Hitler's T4 euthanasia program, where 50,000 Germans were killed in facilities disguised as shower rooms. By replacing murder with clinical terms like granting a mercy death, perpetrators focused on technical efficiency rather than moral reality, creating a parallel moral universe where mass murder became administrative routine. On January 20, 1942, 15 high-ranking officials met at a Berlin villa for 90 minutes that sealed millions of fates. Reinhard Heydrich strategically invited undersecretaries rather than ministers, anticipating resistance. Instead, these civil servants displayed extraordinary enthusiasm, competing to offer efficient murder solutions. they debated whether half-Jews should be killed or sterilized and discussed special cases, like decorated veterans. The meeting's jarring brevity, 90 minutes to plan genocide, followed by drinks and what Eichmann called a cozy little social gathering, eliminated his moral reservations. He experienced a kind of Pontius Pilate feeling, believing himself absolved of responsibility, a psychological mechanism common among Nazi bureaucrats who saw themselves as merely implementing policy. Following Wannsee, the bureaucracy rapidly established comprehensive frameworks, mandatory yellow stars, nationality laws stripping citizenship upon deportation, and property confiscation legislation. At Terrienstadt, Nazis forced prisoners to sign residence acquisition agreements, transferring all property for hollow promises, a final demonstration of bureaucracy perfecting the art of cloaking murder in administrative procedure. The Holocaust's geography defied Nazi expectations. France obstructed deportations. By summer 1943, only 52,000 Jews, under 20%, had been deported, leaving 250,000 to survive. Belgian railway workers unlocked deportation cars, yet Holland suffered catastrophically. 113,000 deported, 3/4 killed. Denmark proved uniquely resistant. When Germans proposed yellow badges, officials said the king would wear one first. In October 1943, fishing fleets ferried nearly 6,000 Jews to Sweden. Italy systematically sabotaged the final solution in occupied zones. Most troubling was Jewish leadership cooperation. Jewish councils compiled deportee lists, secured deportees' money to fund extermination, and supplied police to seize Jews, rationalizing this as saving some by sacrificing others. Rabbi Leo Beck withheld Auschwitz information because living in expectation of death by gassing would only be harder. Without this cooperation, perhaps half could have escaped, aligning with Dutch statistics showing 40 to 50% survival for those underground versus under 1% for those deported officially. Despite overwhelming machinery of death, remarkable resistance emerged. Zindel Grinspan testified how, after 27 years in Germany, his family was suddenly arrested, deported to Poland without food, housed in stables, and left destitute. His 10-minute testimony, 27 years destroyed in 24 hours, possessed a shining honesty, unmatched by other witnesses. The most dramatic moment came when poet Abba Kovner mentioned Anton Schmidt, a German army sergeant who helped Jewish partisans for 5 months, supplying forged papers and military trucks. When Schmidt was arrested and executed, his story created profound silence in the courtroom, like a sudden burst of light in the midst of impenetrable darkness. The lesson? Under terror, most people comply, but some will not. The final solution could happen in most places, but it did not happen everywhere. This minimal human resistance is all that's required for this planet to remain fit for human habitation. On May 31, 1962, Eichmann was hanged. His final words revealed characteristic banality. "After a short while, gentlemen, we shall all meet again." Arendt's banality of evil doesn't mean evil is commonplace. It refers to shocking shallowness manifested in clichés, not demonic depth, but unwillingness to imagine another situation. We face a haunting question in our bureaucratic age. Can we tell right from wrong when guided only by our own judgment, particularly when it contradicts unanimous opinion? Those who maintained moral clarity during the Nazi era decided each case as it arose because no rules existed for the unprecedented. Today, when we follow policies without questioning their human impact, when we hide behind just doing my job, when we substitute procedure for moral thought, we walk dangerously close to Eichmann's path. The antidote? Think for yourself. Imagine others' experiences. Refuse to reduce human beings to administrative units. Because the greatest evil doesn't announce itself with horns and pitchforks. It arrives in a gray suit, speaking in bureaucratic jargon, insisting it's just following orders.